Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Orlando actor David McElroy has been presenting his one-man version of A Christmas Carol for nearly three decades.
Of course, I love Scrooge, but my second and third favorite is Bob and Mrs. Cratchit, because they go through such a transformation.
As thousands of people flock to the Magic Kingdom each day during the holiday season, we'll discuss how Walt Disney was not the first major cartoonist to set up shop in the Sunshine State.
Walt Disney's strongest competitors, Max and David Fleischer, moved their very successful cartoon studios from New York City to Miami.
And we'll talk about researching the memory of Negro Fort. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Molly was dead to begin with. There's no question about that. The register of his burial was signed by the undertaker, the clergyman, the clerk, and his chief mourner, Scrooge, signed it. There's an end to it. Haven't got all day to stand around mourning my deceased partner. He's dead as a doornail, and that's that. My only concern is getting back to the counting house before these Christmas revelers start their din. Bah! Humbug!
Charles Dickens first published A Christmas Carol in 1843 during a period when many modern Christmas traditions were established, such as singing Christmas carols, sending Christmas cards, and decorating Christmas trees. Dickens' A Christmas Carol was instantly very popular. From 1849 to 1870, Dickens himself did public readings of A Christmas Carol, taking on the persona of each character. Since 1997, Orlando actor David McElroy has been staging his own one-man version of A Christmas Carol.
I heard that Patrick Stewart was doing a one-man production of it, and I tried to find it. You know, of course, at the time, the computer system was a little off, so I found a recording of it, and I listened, and it was him basically reading the book, kind of like Charles Dickens did, and then he would interpret the characters as he read. And I talked to Marilyn, my wife, about it, and I said, you know, I'd like to try to take a crack at that. And she said, what do you want to do, read the book? And I said, no. Said I would adapt it and eventually play all the roles. And we worked on it, and I worked on it, and then I had a reading of it, I think, in October of 97. And we decided to mount it, and we did it as a full, kind of a full production with, we had masks for the ghost, we had a bed, a fireplace, all these different things. And then over the years, we've just simplified it because we've gone so many different places. So that's how it got started originally.
David McElroy's daughter, Chloe McElroy, has taken over from her mother, Marilyn, as director of the one-man A Christmas Carol and has been familiar with the production from the beginning.
The first time I actually saw the production was the first show, and my sister and I, with my Girl Scout troop, sang Christmas carols before the show. So I actually remembered that one specifically because I was actually a part of it. And I was actually 6 years old at the time. So I'm in my 30s now. So it's been a very interesting process going from being a child and, you know, watching a full production of it to actually directing it now.
There have been dozens of interpretations of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, from an animated version with Mr. Magoo, many films, and even an opera. Some presentations have significant differences from Dickens' original story. David McElroy stays close to the original source material.
It's almost correct with the novel. The thing I did leave out is he is flown by the Ghost of Christmas Present to a mine underneath the earth, where even the miners are celebrating Christmas and they're far away from their homes. And it's a rather long passage in the book. And I thought, well, that would be a little more difficult, even though I fly with all the other ones. But and the ending in the original Christmas Carol is that he does Bob Cratchit comes in late and he does kind of surprise him and, you know, berate him. And then of course, you know, says, I'm raising your salary. In our production, we go the night before and do it. And then say the next day when you come in, we'll celebrate your newfound wealth and prosperity and happiness with Tiny Tim. So,
over the course of his one man, A Christmas Carol, David McElroy portrays 37 characters without relying heavily on costume pieces or props.
It's vocal and physical. I come in with a top hat and coat, and then I switch into Scrooge during that time. And then after that, I take it off and narrate it. And I just have a white shirt and black pants. I think for one of the children, I put on a hat, and that's the only other time I do any costuming.
My favorite character has always been Mrs. Cratchit. I think that she is really a feisty and fiery woman. And the way that, you know, my dad, David, portrays it, I'm always looking for varieties of expressing the character. You know, I don't want her to just be angry. I don't want her to just be sad, because she's my favorite character. I think I'd probably pay a little more attention to her than I do the other characters. But I definitely really love her, because in a time where she's basically a housewife, she's taking care of all of the Cratchit children while Bob goes to work. And I didn't want her to seem like a typical housewife. And she really doesn't, you know, in the interpretation that David does of her. I think that she's just kind of almost an inspirational character for me. And I really love her. So she's my favorite.
Of course, I love Scrooge, but my second and third favorite is Bob and Mrs. Cratchit, because they go through such a transformation, as does Scrooge. They are almost tied to his coattails. You know, it's like when he's working for him 12 hours a day, making 15 shillings a week. And then he goes from that to eventually prosperity and health for Tiny Tim, who is dying. I just think that they're inspirational. And of course, I love all the characters, because the emotion has carried almost to real life with me over the 25 years. I was kind of acting things before, even though I was doing the emotions, but I now feel emotionally involved with each one of them.
Although David McElroy's A Christmas Carol is a one-man show with daughter Chloe directing, it remains a family affair.
Chloe, she's always said, well, you know, I'd like to do this, call it the Christmas Carol with a woman rather than a man. And I said, well, yeah, you can have it when you take the cold, dead script from my hand. But there's a couple of times I thought, maybe I've done it long enough. But right now I feel great. And it's like going to a gym, really. It's like every year I have to, when we rehearse it, I have to rehearse just half of it first and then the second half. And then we keep going and going. And then finally, by the time, you know, we're up and going, I mean, I'm energized. And by the end, I'm tired, but it's tired energy.
It's definitely something I told him that I would love to possibly take over from him whenever he's ready to let it go. And like he said, I don't know if he'll ever be ready to let it go. Like, I didn't think that we would get this far with it. And look at that, we have. So I did tell him I would eventually like to try to do it before he croaks. So it'd be nice to...
Thank you, dear.
I want him to see me do it once.
David McElroy's one-man version of A Christmas Carol has been performed in multiple venues, from private homes for 2,500 people at the Villages and at Seminole State College, to name a few.
The ghost of Christmas present was radiant and bright. His massive beard with ringlets of curls framed his jolly face, and his head was hung with holly and icicles that clinked together in glorious harmonies. You have never seen the like of me before. Never. Oh, you puny little man. Have you no more walked with my brothers in these later years? I can't say that I have. Have you many brothers, Spirit? More than 1,800. Ooh, that is a tremendous family to provide for. This food smells delicious. May I have some? Of course. And drink some of my wine. You might like it. It's called the milk of human kindness. I don't know about that. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo, it's delicious. Drink some more. You need it.
Southern Winds Theater presents the one-man A Christmas Carol with David McElroy playing all 37 characters. Performances are Friday, December 20th and Saturday, December 21st at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, December 22nd at 3 p.m. at Imagine Performing Arts Center in Oviedo. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org, where you can get free shipping on great books about Florida history and culture through the month of December. You can also watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, many people associate the arrival of Disney in the 1970s with the birth of modern Florida. Whatever the validity of that interpretation, Walt Disney was not the first major cartoonist to locate in the Sunshine State, right?
No, he wasn't. Florida emerged as a tempting location for the film industry very early in its history. As David Morton and others have noted, Jacksonville attracted film companies in the 1910s in what proved to be a short-lived hope or promise as a competitor to Hollywood. In 1938, Florida once again engaged in the fantasy of becoming a film center when Walt Disney's strongest competitors, Max and David Fleischer, moved their very successful cartoon studios from New York City to Miami. Like so many others, their Florida dream did not end with a happy ever after. Donna Dial, an English teacher at the Dade Academy of the Teaching Arts, traced the rise and fall of Fleischer Studios in her article, Cartoons in Paradise, which was published in the winter 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. As she notes, the brothers fought Hollywood, Disney, labor unions, and each other in the rough-and-tumble world of early film. Rising to the top with cartoon characters like Coco the Clown and his canine sidekick Bimbo, Betty Boop, and Popeye, Fleischer Studios succeeded spectacularly in the early days of film cartooning, but fell by the wayside as a result of poor production choices, familial and labor conflicts, and Disney's multiple innovations to the industry, including the introduction of feature-length cartoons.
And probably many people today have no knowledge of Max and Dave Fleischer and their pioneering work, but they may have seen Betty Boop and Popeye cartoons.
The Fleischer Studios had an interesting history that began in New York City and had roots in the ethnic humor of vaudeville traditions. As Dial notes, quote, Max Fleischer entered the new world of animation in 1915 as the inventor of the rotoscope, a machine that converted the movements of filmed actors into amazingly lifelike cartoon characters, end quote. Using the rotoscope to film the motions of his brother Dave, Fleischer created the character Coco the Clown and made the studio's reputation. In 1921, Fleischer Studios partnered with Paramount Pictures to distribute their cartoons. It was the same year Walt Disney launched his own animation company. The partnership changed in 1929 when Paramount gained control over 51% of the stock and copyrights to all the cartoons. The inequality of that agreement would play a role in the downfall of Fleischer Studios. Fleischer's focus on the kind of gritty, over-the-top humor with its sexual innuendo found less audience support by the late 1920s and the Depression years, as cartoons, quote, grew increasingly less gag-driven and more story-oriented, end quote. The audience for cartoons shifted as well from a novelty for adults to entertainment for children. The more artistic Disney cartoons and the 1934 production code forced Fleischer Studios to adapt. The risque Betty Boop, for instance, quote, exchanged her minuscule dress and garter for a more demure frock with a raised neckline and a lowered hem, end quote. As the Fleischers adapted to changing audiences and tastes, they also faced internal production problems. Max Fleischer viewed the company as one big happy family of 200 employees crammed into three floors of 1600 Broadway. But in 1937, his workers walked off the job to protest long hours and short pay. Other companies would face the same demands over the next 5 years, but Fleischer, as the first, was caught off guard. Max Fleischer saw the strike as an example of ingratitude and refused National Labor Relations Board arbitration. The strike ended in October 1937, but set in motion the move to Florida. Adding to their miseries, Disney released Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first full-length animated film in 1937. Paramount pressured Fleischer to create his own feature film, and they made preparations for, quote, a loose, very loose interpretation of Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, end quote. To complete this film meant doubling the staff and abandoning their New York facilities.
Connie, the changing cultural and labor landscape for animation led Fleischer Studios to abandon its historic association with New York to seek a new location. Why did they choose Miami, and what was Miami's response?
The choice of Miami seems to have been based on several factors. Max and Dave Fleischer already owned beach houses in Miami. Land was cheap, and Florida exempted relocating film companies from property taxes. Florida did not support unions, making an expansion of the workforce less fraught, and Miami began soliciting the animation company during the labor strike. That said, one observer noted, quote, Miami might as well have been in Tibet. Every foot of film had to be shipped to New York laboratories for development. Any breakdown of equipment would have to be serviced from the East. There were few experienced sound engineers in Florida, no actors, no labor pool of experienced artists, end quote. The Fleischers broke ground on the new animation studio March 1, 1938. Miami was delighted. The Miami Herald proclaimed, quote, Miami's dream of a motion picture industry at long last seems about to be realized. Miami wants and needs this new enterprise, end quote. The studio was placed on land being developed by John Ware Jr. in the northwest section of Dade County. Ware envisioned Fleischer Studios as the centerpiece of Delaware Park, an upscale housing development of concrete hurricane-proof homes surrounded by lush landscaping and natural limestone pools. But the transition to Miami was not smooth. New Yorkers found the still rural nature of Dade County and the climate a difficult adjustment. Coming from a city more tolerant of racial, ethnic, and religious differences, they were sometimes met with hostility, as when Max Fleischer received an intimidating note from the local Ku Klux Klan after hosting Cab Calloway for dinner at his home. The move was off to a rocky start and would get worse. Fleischer Studios brought 200 New Yorkers to work at the Miami facility and added 200 more from California. They successfully defeated a CIO attempt to unionize the studio, but did not receive the expected tax break. The brothers fell out with one another over an alleged extramarital affair between Dave and his secretary. Their Popeye cartoons continued to be very popular, but Gulliver's Travels, although opening to great fanfare in Miami, received mixed but overall positive reviews, not the raves that the Fleischers hoped would accompany the world's second feature-length cartoon. Meanwhile, Disney was hard at work on Pinocchio, and Paramount began pressuring Fleischer Studios for another film. The film was titled Mr. Bug Goes to Town. While Max Fleischer stressed the importance of the story as a community of insects, the film opened 3 days before Pearl Harbor to little fanfare and failed to recoup expenses. With debts to Paramount of $573,000 for its two feature films, Dave Fleischer resigned to work for Columbia Pictures, and Max took a position in Detroit producing Army training films. Paramount seized the property in May 1942. Dial concludes with a view of Miami as a city that serves as a site for filmmaking, not the film center once envisioned. Remnants of Delaware Park and the Delaware Parkway still exist as quirky houses and a four-lane roadway that runs past the old studio before disappearing at the Miami River.
Interesting as always. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
The Wonderful World of Disney.
This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has been researching the memory of Nigro Fort with John Lancaster for a podcast on that topic.
John Lancaster is a master's history student at the University of Central Florida, specializing in mid to late 20th century European history through the lens of historical memory. John and I presented at the recent Florida Historical Society annual meeting and symposium in a panel titled, quote, "The History and Memory of Nigro Fort, Tracing Its Legacy Through Time and Adapting Its Story for the Podcast Medium," end quote. I spoke with John about his specific research regarding Nigro Fort memory in the 19th century and his overall perspective on this collaborative research project, which began in Dr. Barbara Gannon's graduate history colloquium on American slavery.
We read a selection of important books on the topic, one of which was Matthew Clavin's 2019 book, The Battle of Nigro Fort. And this book introduced me to the entire concept of the fort, which before that I didn't even know existed. It was a fort that existed near Tallahassee along the Apalachicola River in the panhandle of Florida. The fort was initially constructed by the British during the War of 1812. And following the war, when the British evacuated the fort, they left the fortifications and all of their weaponry to a group of growing Native American and Black Maroons. And between 1815 and 1816, these Maroons lived at the fort, where they lived as a self-sufficient community. Because they were left with a significant amount of weapons and ammunition, they also presented pretty significant anxieties to the southern states in the early 19th century, as they represented a significant form of resistance to slavery and a growing slaveocracy that characterized 19th century southern ideologies.
From my specific research, Nigro Fort memory has fluctuated significantly since the 20th century. John, however, discovered a different pattern in the 19th century.
What I found in my own research was that the memory of Nigro Fort in the 19th century was comparatively robust. And I found a lot of different writers and commentators throughout the 19th century engaged with the memory of the fort for their own unique reasons. So for example, abolitionists before the Civil War engaged with a particular memory of the fort to bolster their own ideologies. Postbellum writers engaged with the memory to help justify Jim Crow era ideologies, and even African American writers in the postbellum era utilized the memory of Nigro Fort as a means of resistance at a time of continued Black community oppression. For example, one source that I found particularly fascinating was written by a Black educator in Georgia whose name was Edward Austin Johnson. He worked in a number of segregated schools in Georgia throughout the late 19th century, and he wrote a book in the early 1890s, The History of the Negro Race between 1619 and 1890. And his goal in writing this textbook, which was written for children, was to help give this new generation of Black Americans an insight into their recent history, considering that most of these people had parents or grandparents who had been enslaved. And Johnson recollects the story of Nigro Fort in this example, and paints quite a graphic and visceral picture of what happened during the destruction of the fort in order to reflect some of the issues contemporaneous to his own time. Again, a time of continued Black oppression and violence committed against Black communities.
Part of our panel aimed to demonstrate how the podcast medium represents a unique space for traditional academic research, especially for Nigro Fort memory. John shared his perspective as someone who, before this research project, had no experience producing academic historical podcasts.
I have written conference papers before, and I have written academic papers before. And so I was delighted and actually surprised to find out that there were a lot of overlaps between writing academic traditional conference papers and adapting them to the podcast medium. Although it was a new experience for me, it wasn't completely impossible to understand. That being said, I think some of the important takeaways I've learned from this experience is how certain elements of the podcast medium can be used to engage audiences even more with the projects that I work on. So for example, certain elements of the podcast medium, like music and sound effects, provoke emotion in audiences. And emotion is something that is crucial to memory. And when writing a traditional conference paper or an academic paper in a class, memory is often intellectualized in a way where, though emotion certainly is a crucial aspect of it for many people and how they engage with memory, doesn't necessarily come across that way in an academic paper. Now, that's not to say that in podcasting, especially an academic historical podcast, we don't engage intellectually with concepts like memory. However, for larger audiences, engaging with memory through elements like music and voiceovers create a much more visceral experience for audiences, which is one element that I really appreciated with the podcast medium. Additionally, this topic on Negro Fort especially proved useful to adapting to this medium because Negro Fort is obscured in American history and in historical memory generally. And podcasting, on the other hand, has only been growing in popularity and is not obscured at all. And so one of our biggest draws to adapting this story for the podcast medium was to help illuminate the whole story of Negro Fort and how people have engaged with it through time and kind of challenge some of the narratives that suggest that Negro Fort was always this obscured. And one of the best ways that we found to do it was to utilize all the elements of the podcast medium in order to bring it to the largest audience possible and illustrate its historical significance.
Given John's interest in historical memory, researching Negro Fort Remembers provided a space to refine his understanding and skills regarding memory.
Certainly, the emphasis on memory remains the most significant takeaway that I've had from this entire project. As with anything that you learn, practice makes perfect, to use the analogy. And being able to engage with primary source materials and considering how they interact with the historical moments that they were produced in really allowed me a crucial space to better understand memory.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can also listen as a podcast or anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Happy holidays. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.